Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Parking in Wilmington is drawing scrutiny from advocates who call enforcement and fines unfair and see little room for people to fight back.
I think the biggest complaint that people have is the appeals process. There seems to be no rhyme or reason. And the city is monitoring their own appeals, which some people feel is unfair because it's like you're asking yourself to police yourself.
Contributor Mark Faust reports on the battle over parking in the state's largest city. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn more about two charter schools, expansion plans, and the renewable fuel credits Delaware City Refinery says is causing it financial distress. Plus, Arts Playlist previews the Surfin' Summer Music Festival. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. A pair of charter schools become the latest to gain approval to expand by adding new grades. Academy of Dover and Gateway Lab School will both become K-8 schools in the coming years. Contributor Larry Nagengast looks at each school's expansion plans and what those plans mean for their students in his latest piece at DelawarePublic.org. And we talked to Larry earlier this week to learn more about what these schools are doing. Larry, these two schools are both moving to a K-8 format, but kind of coming at it from different directions. Let's start with the Academy of Dover. What is it doing?
Well, okay, the Academy of Dover opened in 2003, serving kindergarten through sixth grade, and its leaders planned then to eventually expand into a K-8 program. Over the years, however, the school struggled to keep its enrollments up, and at one point it even dropped its sixth grade class, and then it brought it back last year. And the expectation then was that it would eventually add grades 7 and 8. The request for a major modification to its charter, which was approved last month by the State Board of Education, allows it to do just that, and so they'll be starting with a seventh grade program in the fall.
And the rationale is one that we've seen before, that the parents want this. The parents are kind of uncomfortable with a K-6 setup, right?
Well, it wasn't so much discomfort as a desire by parents to have their children stay at the school through their middle school years. You know, when you've got fewer than 60 students per grade, which is the situation at the Academy of Dover, you've got an intimate environment. And there are a good number of parents who feel that their children will learn more comfortably in this setting than they would in a larger middle school. And of course, the other thing is that if you can keep a child in the same building for K-8, that's one less switch, one less transition that they have to go through during their academic career.
That's right. They just have to go from middle school to high school rather than doing the elementary to middle to high school the switches.
Yes.
So the changes that they're making also include an expansion of their building footprint, right? Can you explain what's going on with that?
Yeah, well, there's enough space in the Academy's current building to fit the seventh grade classes, but there's not enough room to include eighth grade. So the Academy of Dover is in a building that it rents, and the owner of the property that the Academy rents is going to put up a new building right next to the existing one that will accommodate both the seventh and the eighth grades. Now, this new building is supposed to be ready in time for the 2022-2023 school year, and that's going to be the year that the school will have its first eighth grade class. So this year, the seventh graders in the expansion will be in the existing building. Next year, a new building will be up, and it will accommodate both the seventh and the eighth grade classes.
You had mentioned the Academy of Dover is kind of a smaller school, more intimate setting for students, and it doesn't expect that to change much, right, in terms of this expansion. Their personality and who they serve, they figure is going to stay largely the same, right?
Right, yeah. Essentially, what we're talking about here is, adding another 40 or so students per grade. And, it's going to remain essentially in the same intimate setting with just two more grade levels.
And more or less, they draw pretty locally, right? They don't have a pretty expansive footprint from which they draw, correct?
That's correct. Roughly half of the students come from the Capital School District, which is right. Well, that's the would be the home district if the County of Dover had been a traditional public school. And then you've got Caesar Rodney as well, which is just to the south of Dover. Smyrna to the north, and then you get a very small number of students coming from places like Middletown on the north. Or Milford on the south, but it's largely Capital School District and Caesar Rodney School District residents who are attending the school.
So let's now move over to the Gateway Lab School. What are they doing to become a full K-8 operation?
Well, while Academy of Dover is expanding at the back end, the 7th and the 8th grades, Gateway is going to grow at the front end, adding kindergarten through 2nd grade to what is now a grade 3-8 program. The first kindergarten students would enroll in the fall of 2022. Essentially, if you're interested in attending kindergarten at Gateway, you would apply in the fall when the choice program enrollments are open and for enrollment in 2022. And then this three-year phase-in that the school would be going through would ultimately create a K-8 school program as of the start of the 24-25 school year.
And what prompted their move to expand on this end of things, that K-3 end?
Well, Gateway is a school where the third grade is not a normal entry point for students to start public school or to start any school. Normally, you're coming in at kindergarten or first grade, or you're coming in at the middle school level. So third grade is kind of an odd spot to get started. Now, the school had planned all along to eventually go K-8, and this is an opportunity to get themselves on that path. Starting in kindergarten, you get a more normal starting point. Kids come in at the third grade. The school found often come in because parents are not pleased with how the kids had been doing at their previous school. They may very well have fallen behind. So you're starting out with kids who are behind grade level at the third grade. You start them out at kindergarten, first grade in your program. You've got a better chance, the school leaders believe, to help them progress at the appropriate pace and maintain grade level without falling behind.
And as part of this expansion, Gateway is also going to change its name from Gateway Lab School. How does that fit into this expansion plan and the school's overall mission?
Well, I think it's going to help clarify. It'll probably help in terms of the expansion in that the name change is going to make it easier for people to understand what the school is all about. So let's talk about that name a little bit. The name Gateway Lab School was established by the school's founder, Pam Draper, because she wanted to model the school's curriculum and its teaching methods after the Lab School of Washington, D.C., which is a program that she knew about and that she admired. And now this Gateway is going to change, and its new name is going to be the Gateway Charter School. And that's actually the school's legal name on its legal documents. And that change from Lab School to Charter School is going to be phased in over the next year or so through a marketing and rebranding campaign. So now here's what the problem was. When Gateway calling itself a lab school, well, people didn't really understand what that really meant, and it didn't really identify it as a charter school. So many people thought that it was a private school as opposed to a public charter school that doesn't charge tuition. So you've got this thing going on where the the public is unclear as to what the school is. And on top of that, they think that it's a private school rather than a public school, and that it's going to cost them thousands of dollars to send their child there. And these, you know, things like that, you know, can have a negative effect on potential enrollment. So changing the name hopefully is going to make it easier for the school leaders to describe the program more succinctly, and therefore potentially draw from a larger base of potential students.
And like the Academy at Dover, Gateway is also preparing for some building changes. What's going on there, and what are their options as to how they're going to kind of set themselves up in terms of their kind of physical footprint?
Well, you know, again, there's nothing really definite here yet. But our Gateway, which is located over near Price's Corner, it's in the former St. Catherine of Siena Catholic School building. And the school's operators, you know, like many families, decided that, you know, hey, sometimes it's better to own than to pay rent. And so the school is now looking for another centrally located site in New Castle County, or northern New Castle County. You know, just Price's Corner is fairly convenient to most parts of the northern part of the county, north of the canal. So, you know, what they're looking for, it's not certain. They're looking at various options. It could be another vacant school, and there are several of them around, or it could be another vacant building, a former retail space, or something, a storage warehouse building, something like that would be a possibility. Or, you know, it could be a site where there's raw land to build on. They're not quite sure. They're looking at all of those possibilities. Now, Gateway is not under any pressure to move, at least not right away. They've got one more year left to go on their lease with St. Catherine of Siena, and they've got an option for a year following that. And as you would expect, I mean, there's not like there's a booming market for people out there looking to rent vacant Catholic school buildings. So I mean, if they stay put for another year or two or three, it's not a big deal, you know, for them. They can manage that. You know, but anyhow, there are many variables to consider in this renting versus owning discussion. But owning it is likely to cost less than renting, and if you own your own property, you know, you've got greater control over your own expenses over the long haul. So my suspicion is that they're going to wind up owning their own building. The question right now becomes, where is that going to be?
So looking at both of these expansions, there seems like there's a bit of a pattern here, that the charter landscape now is less about adding new charter schools and maybe more about existing schools tweaking what they're doing based on what they're seeing and hearing, especially from their families and students. Is that a fair assessment?
That's the good short answer, certainly. I mean, especially if you look at Gateway, where, as I said, third grade just isn't a natural starting point. Like with the Academy of Dover, we have seen other charters that have been tweaking their upper grade structure, often by deciding whether or not to include middle school grades, you know, depending upon parental interest and the level of competition in the education marketplace. Now, we talked a couple of weeks ago about the early college high school in Dover adding, you know, adding middle school grades. There have been others that have also built from the lower grades on up. First State Montessori in Wilmington is another one that's, you know, gone up and added seventh and eighth. So, and one aspect that's worth mentioning here is that charter schools, which are typically smaller and typically have only one building and a board of directors that's got a very much singular focus, can make changes like these a lot faster than a traditional school district can. There is a planning process and approval from the state is required, but it's a lot easier to develop and to sell a plan when your constituency is, well, 300, 400, 500 families, as opposed to a school district where those numbers of people that you have to convince and get on board is very often up in the thousands.
Yeah, and you don't have to do a referendum either.
Yeah, no, that's true. You don't have to go to a referendum, but you know, this is another can of worms. Charter schools do have to pay for their own buildings, so there is the issue of being able to either squirrel away a lot of money over a period of years, or run some sort of a capital campaign right. to get the construction. So it's not quite as easy as that, but there's a different set of issues involved there.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nightingale for his time this week. His piece on Academy of Dover and Gateway Lab School expansion plans is available at DelawarePublic.org. And stay tuned. Contributor Mark Fowler joins us next with an update on the long-running battle over parking in the city of Wilmington. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Ticketing, towing, booting, and stymied appeals. A recently formed coalition says it's documented a troubling pattern in Wilmington and wants the city to open its books to show how it tows and tickets. But the city says for there to be meaningful dialogue, there has to be some agreement on the facts. Delaware Public Media's Mark Fowler reports on this brewing battle over parking in the state's largest city.
3 years ago, Erin Markham moved into Wilmington.
While I was moving into my home, I came outside and I had a ticket on my windshield.
She says she tried to be clear about the law beforehand as she moved into her home on Baynard Boulevard and admits the misunderstanding was on her part. But her request for clemency was denied. The portion of Baynard Boulevard where Markham lives is a no-stopping zone during commuting hours, in her case between 4 and 6 p.m. Parking enforcement was suspended in Wilmington early in the pandemic, except in egregious cases. Then in July, ticketing resumed in the Central Business District and at the riverfront. Markham says she and her neighbors continued to park in front of their homes. Then on October 8th, she received a ticket for violating the no-stopping restriction. She was able to get it waived, pointing out that she parked in a residential district. Then, about a month later,
I wasn't home during the time, so I didn't get everything, but on November 4th, 5th, and 6th, I get back-to-back tickets issued for this same thing.
It became evident that a parking enforcement officer was visiting the area each day after 4 p.m. to issue tickets. Markham recorded a conversation with an officer, who radioed his boss to make sure he was doing the right thing.
We get us a yes. Yes, we are enforcing. If it's a white to own out there, make sure you get a very good picture of that vehicle.
Oh, tell her I'm right here.
Okay, just issue the ticket and explain the appeal process. We are enforcing the no stopping from 4-6 as posted.
That contradicts what the mayor said.
Oh, I was absolutely targeted. I was angry and frustrated, but at the same time, almost happy that I was recording this, because now I have additional proof that, you know, there are some unfair practices happening in Wilmington parking enforcement.
Markham is not alone in her feelings about parking enforcement in Wilmington, and she now has some help responding to the issues that she sees with it. A group known as the Wilmington Parking Coalition is examining parking and towing trends in the city and raised some pointed questions to Mayor Mike Perzicki and members of Wilmington City Council. Utilizing city data, some of which was obtained under the Freedom of Information Act, they point out that despite months of reduced parking enforcement, there did not seem to be a significant difference in the number of vehicles towed between 2019 and 2020. Frequent ticketing is something that Steve Villanueva with the Latin American Community Center has taken note of.
Clients that have that are in below poverty level, staff that are working in, under nonprofit wages. And for us to get tickets and clients to get tickets in this neighborhood is absolutely crazy.
Another common complaint is the inability of drivers to take their cases to the Justice of the Peace Court. Robert Johnson is senior attorney with the Institute for Justice, based in Arlington, Virginia.
People are waiting months or years to get a decision. In some cases, they're not getting a decision at all. And the city is making it difficult or even impossible for people who have been issued these tickets to see a real judge.
Instead, they often get denials and advisories that if they want to pursue the case and don't win, they would be held responsible for court costs. The coalition wants a complete and thorough audit of Wilmington's ticketing, appeals, towing, booting, and collection system. City Councilwoman at Large Maria Cabrera says she hears a lot of complaints about parking enforcement.
I think the biggest complaint that people have is the appeals process. There seems to be no rhyme or reason. And the city is monitoring their own appeals, which some people feel is unfair, because it's like you're asking yourself to police yourself.
The City of Wilmington responded to the Parking Coalition's questions in detail, summarizing the city's towing and ticketing practices are consistent with the law and are performed with due process afforded to the public and ethical standards of conduct. Vehicle owners are not being taken advantage of. No one is being denied an appeal. The city also contends that there is no profiteering in parking enforcement, and currently the cost of providing parking enforcement services in Wilmington exceeds the revenue generated by the program, even prior to the suspension of certain ticketing during the pandemic. In answering the city's response, Delaware Center for Justice Policy Coordinator Kaylin Richards says in a statement that the coalition is optimistic about starting a dialogue on behalf of constituents, and the fact that the city took 4 weeks to respond underscores the confusing nature of Wilmington's parking, booting, towing, and appeal system. Second District Councilwoman Shanae Darby says even beyond looking at fairness and legality, she's hoping to examine the entire parking fee structure. Wilmington's $40 parking ticket meets or exceeds those in some much larger cities.
Where we're going to focus on analyzing what those fees and fines are, right? How much are they? Who is being impacted? Really getting those questions answered.
Because for some, a parking ticket or impounded vehicle is more than just an inconvenience.
When a person loses a vehicle, it has a devastating effect on the family, and it really harms overwhelmingly people of color and people living on low income.
When Dominique Grant resided downtown, she went through the experience of having her car towed and months of frustration in trying to get it back from a tow company that turned out to be operating without a business license in the city.
They told me that the only way I could get my car back is that if I wouldn't sue them for any damages.
Grant's ordeal began before the pandemic. The company kept her car all this time, and she pursued her case in Justice of the Peace Court. And earlier this month, a judge ruled in her favor, but granted her no damage. She plans to follow up in small claims court for additional damages, including punitive.
If they can charge me $500 after 2 days, then they should be prepared to pay if they mess up as well. They shouldn't be able to just get away with just returning my car after breaking the law.
It's the sort of experience that turns people off from living in or visiting Wilmington, according to Cabrera.
We want people to come to the city. We got to be a user-friendly city. And if our fines are prohibitive, and if our practices are prohibitive or predatory, then it's not going to happen. We got to do better.
But as a council member, she's also a fiscal watchdog.
It should be revenues that come in, but it shouldn't be projected revenues that we count on to balance our budget, because that's where you get that overzealousness to meet those goals.
As for Erin Markham, she's frustrated to the point where she'd consider leaving Wilmington, but doesn't want to do so with a parking ticket pending.
I'm not going to back down.
Mark Fauser, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Mark. And The Green returns in a moment with more on efforts to reform a system of renewable fuel credits that the owner of the Delaware City Refinery says is causing it some financial strain. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The owner of the Delaware City Refinery is renewing its effort to get some relief from renewable fuel credits the refinery is required to purchase. And it's getting support from Delaware's congressional delegation and Governor John Carney. Contributor John Hurl takes a look at these credits and why they are getting attention now in his latest piece, available at DelawarePublic.org. And he joined me earlier this week to recap what he learned. So let's start by reminding our listeners exactly what these renewable fuel credits are that the Delaware City Refinery's owner is required to buy, and why they exist to begin with.
Well, these things are called RINs, which is an acronym. It stands for Renewable Identification Numbers.
And these are credits that must be purchased by any refiner that doesn't have the capacity to produce its own biofuels or to add them to gasoline. And that's the case with Delaware City. And these are credits that are required under the something called the Renewable Fuel Standard. It's something that's been required by the EPA for about the last decade, and the idea is that it boosts consumption of biofuels like ethanol by adding it to gasoline or diesel.
And the reason why a refinery like Delaware City winds up having to pay them is because they're a relatively small operation, and doing the biofuels themselves is probably something that wouldn't work for them economically.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They don't have the capacity to produce these biofuels or to blend them into gasoline, diesel. And so in order to comply with the EPA standards, they have to buy these credits.
Now, PBF Energy has been saying for some time now that these credits are becoming a growing burden on them. Can you tell us a little bit about how much they're spending to meet this requirement we're talking about and why it is so much they have to spend?
Well, the PBF says that company-wide, and this is not only for Delaware City, but they have five other refineries around the United States. Company-wide, PBF spent about $325 million on these RINs, these credits, in 2020, which is about twice what it spent in 2019. And that was because of a sharp increase in the price of the credits, and the reason for that is that the credits are traded in the financial markets, and allegedly they are subject to market manipulation, and there's been a great deal of volatility in those markets, resulting in a very high, a very sharp increase in the RINs price quite lately. What all of that means for PBF is that buying the RINs is RINs are now its second biggest expense after crude oil.
So do we understand what some of the factors are that are creating this volatility on the market and the uncertainty that's perhaps driving up these prices?
Well, on the uncertainty, there is an issue with the EPA, and the EPA has acknowledged this, that they have yet to set RFS standards. That is the requirement for the amount of biofuels that has to be added to gasoline and diesel for 2021, and they are, by their own admission, several months late in setting those standards, and they have to do the same thing for 2022, and so that's part of the uncertainty that's creating problems for PBF and other independent refiners, as we said, the market volatility. They don't know what expenses they're going to have to face because of the sharp increase or the uncertainty of the prices in the market. And in fact, PBF told me that if the credit prices stay at their current levels, the company is likely to have to pay more in credit prices this year than they did last.
So what is the company hoping will be done to mitigate this volatility in the market? And I guess this is where we ask the question, where do Governor John Carney and Delaware's congressional delegation fit into the equation to try to kind of mitigate the issue that the refinery and its owner are facing?
Well, the delegation is urging the EPA to quickly issue its renewable fuel standards for 2021 and to finalize those for next year as soon as possible. And they're also asking the EPA to work with the federal market regulator, that is the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, to stop manipulation of the RINs market, which is creating such volatility in the price. The delegation's also saying that even though they fully support a national transition to more sustainable transportation fuels, they're saying that, well, while the country remains dependent on and petroleum for its for gasoline and diesel, that those products should be made at U.S.-based refiners like that in Delaware City.
And it's not surprising that the governor and the congressional delegation would be interested in this, because the refinery still remains a pretty big employer in this state, and you know, any issues they have that could lead to trouble is something that certainly government officials here are worried about.
Well, indeed. The refinery employs about 535 people as full-time employees, and they at different times employ about another 1,000 as contractors. And so, you know, the refinery plays a significant role in Delaware's economy, and therefore, of course, our elected representatives are very concerned about the future.
So we've talked a lot about the EPA being kind of at the heart of this matter. What has the EPA had to say about the situation and how quickly it may act to do some of these things that it's being asked to do?
Well, they're not committing themselves to any timeline on this. They're saying that they are working on the latest RFS standards for this year and next. They've also saying that they are setting that they have set rules that are designed to curb market manipulation for these credits, but they're still assessing whether those rules are effective.
Now, there are those people who defend the renewable fuels standard and these credits and the way they operate and what they do in terms of improving things environmentally. Can you tell us a little bit about who supports this and what their arguments are for kind of maintaining something close to the status quo?
Well, the counter argument is that refiners like PBF have had significant challenges, particularly because of the pandemic over the last year and the plunge in the economy. They're not justified in blaming their financial woes on the requirement to pay to buy the credits, because the critics say the companies are able to pass on those costs to their customers. And the other criticism is that the renewable fuel standards has actually played an important role in boosting the use of non-fossil fuels since the enabling law was passed in 2007. So the argument is that the challenges faced by companies like PBF are really based on the economy or on technological issues, which is one of the problems that was that contributed to the demise or the closure of the Philadelphia Energy Solutions refinery a couple of years ago.
And you reported on that a couple of years ago for us and its relationship to the Delaware City Refinery. And with that in mind, where do PBF Energy and the Delaware City Refinery stand right now financially? Are they in significant financial peril? Could they shutter like the plant in Philadelphia?
Well, PBF, various officials have issued kind of dark warnings that, they haven't been specific about Delaware City being under threat of closure, but what they say is that refiners in their category, that is independent merchant refiners, their survival of companies like that may be in question unless there is a reform of the renewable fuel standard. Having said all that, PBF says that its financial situation has actually significantly improved. In the first quarter of this year, its losses narrowed very significantly, and so they're doing better than they did, and they attribute that mostly to a rollout in COVID vaccines and a gradual ramping up or a recovery in the overall economy.
So, what are the likely paths forward here, and do we have a sense of what the timeline might be for a resolution to this issue?
Well, I think the timeline is unclear. I mean, the parties are in talks. PBF and its representatives are actively talking to the EPA. The EPA says it's working on it, as we discussed. The other factor here is that everybody is waiting for a U.S. Supreme Court ruling on whether RFS exemptions for small refiners can be renewed. And, of course, it's anybody's guess as to when the court is likely to rule on that. So I think it's a lot of the various parties seem to agree that most of the parties seem to agree that there needs to be some reform here, but it's really unclear as to when that might happen.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time this week, his piece on the status of renewable fuel credits and their impact on the Delaware City Refinery is available at DelawarePublic.org. And we close out the show next with Arts Playlist and more on the Seraphim Summer Music Festival returning next month, offering performances in person and online. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Seraphim Summer Music returns live starting next week with a 3-week chamber music festival. The schedule offers 7 concerts open to the public, live and live streamed from the concert hall at the Music School of Delaware in Wilmington. And in this week's Arts Playlist, Seraphim Summer Music's artistic director, Kate Ransom, chats with R. Kelly Steele about these concerts and their various themes.
Hey, let's talk about Seraphim Summer Music returning live in June. This is a 3-week chamber music festival featuring a lot of performances. So jump right in. Tell me all about it.
Oh, we're so excited. First of all, to connect again with audiences and for our 22 artists coming in from all over the country, we're very delighted to be able to collaborate together again. It's been a really long 14 or 15 months, and we've all missed it, audiences and performers alike. We have 7 concerts over the period from June 4th through June 19th, and so each weekend we have 3 concerts the first weekend, June 4th through 6th, and then 2 concerts the following weekend on Friday and Saturday, and then finally 2 concerts with a grand finale on June 19th.
Kate, does each concert have a theme, if you will?
They do have themes, and that's a lot of fun. The programming is really eclectic. The instruments range from strings and piano, which is kind of standard chamber music fare, to oboes, English horn, horn, and voice. We also have some selections that include the flute. So we have a lot of variety this summer. The festival opens with a concert on June 4th that's called Gershwin by George, and it's an all Gershwin program. We have a program that's all Norwegian composers or songs of Norway, or tributes to Norway. One of the fun concerts we're doing is 3 pairs of accomplished siblings, each pair playing violin and the other playing piano. And we do a program that's a lot of fun called Sibling Rivalry.
After last year, this must be so exciting, just as you said, to get back live in front of people. You mentioned that the artists for this roster are coming in from all over. Where are they coming from?
That's correct. We have artists that are coming in from Chicago, from Florida, from the Atlanta area, And also from New York. So it's a wide variety. We have an artist coming from New Orleans and one coming from just outside Cincinnati and one who's actually in the university now in Oregon. So it's a wide array. And also some of these artists are actually international background. So we have the rising star Cucharon siblings. David Cucharon is the concertmaster of the Atlanta Symphony, phenomenal violinist, and his sister, Julie Cucharon, is a marvelous pianist. They're Norwegian, and they have quite a following in Norway. They play at the Kon-Tiki Festival every summer, but we're very fortunate to be able to have them here.
I want to remind everybody, we're talking to Kate Ransom. Kate is not a stranger to the show. She's been on many times. She is the artistic director for the Seraphin Summer Music. We're talking about their lineup, this big festival they're having in June. It's the Chamber Music Festival. It's a three-week event featuring seven performances, 22 acclaimed artists from around the nation. You just heard Kate talk about some of them. What does this mean? I mean, I can hear the excitement in your voice, but what does this mean for you guys to get back out and play in front of a live audience?
It is such an emotional experience, I think, of joyfulness and actually maybe a little bit of relief, too, and renewed hope about the future and getting back to work, getting back to what we do. Chamber music especially really relies on the ability to collaborate in groups of three, four, five musicians together. And our connection with the audience is just a priceless experience. So it's really important to all of us, and it's a very exciting time that we can now start to do this again.
Kate, the festival, of course, being hosted by the Music School of Delaware, it's home. Give us some background for people who are not familiar.
Well, this is the second time we've run the festival. So the inaugural year was in 2019. The board of directors of the Music School of Delaware adopted it as a program of the school. And it fills a niche that isn't really addressed by other offerings in the state of Delaware to have, a festival of chamber music drawing artists from all over the nation is really a special thing to do. And we want to be part of making Delaware an arts and culture destination. And this is a piece of that big puzzle. We're not by any means the only thing, but this is an arts-rich state, and it's just not publicized enough. People don't know the riches of arts, all kinds of music, and art making is going on and at a very, very high level in Delaware. So it should be the state of the arts. Delaware should be the state of the arts, and yeah. We should crow about it.
Yeah, I believe you. All the chickens out there, right? Is it chickens that crow? I don't even know. I'm not an animal person. So, hey, we talked about the themes. How did you come up with the themes for this festival?
Well, I think about the repertoire that I would like to play and the artists that I'd like to invite. And I just start, it's sort of like doing a big puzzle, and I start to put those together, and then I sometimes come up with the themes that way. So the theme sometimes evolves out of that. So we have a program, for example, called Lovers, Friends, and Mentors, and that basically was a chance to present the music of Brahms, Dvorak, who revered Brahms, and both the Schumanns, Robert Schumann and Clara Schumann, who were part of a very special triangle, if you will, with Brahms. So, that allowed us to play some glorious works by those composers, some that are familiar and some that are not so well known, but absolutely gorgeous, and also to assemble a wonderful lineup of violin, viola, cello, and also oboe, mezzo-soprano, and piano on that program.
Wow, this is just phenomenal. Okay, so we do want to mention this, that everybody that purchases a ticket for this music festival will have access to the patron-exclusive Serafins Backstage. What is Serafins Backstage?
Well, that's something new this time around. This is the second time we've done the festival. Unfortunately, it had to be suspended last year. But, you know, we wanted to repeat a lot of the things that were so wonderful about the inaugural year, but then we wanted to add something extra. So for ticket holders, they're going to be invited to a behind-the-scenes chat by Zoom with the artists that week. So each week there'll be a Serafins Backstage program. And with the ticket purchase, even just one ticket purchase, the patrons will get access to those special Zoom gatherings on the Thursday evenings at 5:30 each week.
Okay, talk about where people can get tickets and the price of tickets.
Sure. Tickets are on sale now at musicschoolofdelaware.org. Or you can call 302-762-1132. For tickets. Single tickets are $20 or $10 for a student with ID. That you can also save a little bit by doing a three-pack of tickets, any three tickets. It could be three tickets for the same concert or three different concerts. And that's a little bit of a price reduction. The full season is also a price reduction for $120 for seven performances. And like I said, they're on sale now, musicschoolofdelaware.org. We will have limited seating on site because of the COVID regulations, but we have unlimited virtual access via the live stream.
That's fantastic. All right, Kate, final words about this three-week chamber music festival.
Just really looking forward to these wonderful artists being in town, connecting with the community, and making beautiful music. Serafin Summer Music 2021.
Thanks to Serafin Summer Music's artistic director, Kate Ransom, and R. Kelly Steele for joining us on this week's Arts Playlist. And that's all we have for this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green can also be found via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible. Contributors Mark Fowler, John Hurdle, and Larry Nagengest, and Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernsink. Thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week here on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.